Welcome to Vital Connections On Air, a podcast brought to you by University of Minnesota Extension's Center for Community Vitality that explores the trends and topics important to communities and leaders throughout Minnesota. My name is Christy Kalavig, and today I am joined by Ben Winchester, who is a senior research fellow with the Center for Community Vitality, as we discuss the leadership gap in Minnesota. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Christy.
Thanks so much for joining us today. As a research fellow, you do a variety of work within the center and in communities across not only Minnesota, but really throughout the U.S. What motivates you to do this research and work to better understand our communities?
Well, number one, I love small towns and rural places, and I think they are really great places to help understand how the world is changing. I think a lot of the changes that we see in the world take place first in our small towns. So I continue to do applied research, is what we call it, on topics relevant to small towns and rural areas.
Well, it's very interesting work, and I know that we have all definitely benefited from the work that you did around the brain gain, which we've talked about previously on this podcast. And I'm really excited to dig into this concept of a leadership gap today. So what have you found in communities that led you to discover this gap in leadership that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think there were two things. Number one, I had a really basic question about, how many people do we need to run our town? And it's, you know, when you think about how a leadership, and I'm talking about positional leadership here, people that are, you know, appointed or elected to different governmental positions, whether it's at the city council level or the county commissioner level, or even things like soil and water conservation districts and sewer districts. We've got all these kind of governmental agencies that require leaders. But at the same time, we've got, especially in Minnesota here, a really thriving civic life in terms of participation in nonprofits. So when you kind of add those two together, that's, you know, my official statistical term is bean counting. When you count the beans, the number of groups that you've got that demand leaders, and compare that to the number of people that you've got that can supply leadership. So it's really a basic demand and supply model where organizations demand people and people supply leadership. And it's kind of a, you know, an economist way of looking at it, but really I wanted to better understand, we hear a lot of anecdotes about people wearing multiple hats and that we're overextended and, you know, but it's really very rarely backed up by data. So the second thing I found was a great data set from the National Center for Charitable Statistics. And they provide us data on the number of nonprofits, the type of nonprofits you've got, and this is all at the county level, as well as things like assets and revenue of those nonprofits and other traits related to the nonprofit sector. So that allowed me then to really start digging into understanding, you know, how many leaders does it take and how many leaders do we have in our small towns?
And so how many leaders does it take? And are we really running short of leaders?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So, you know, initially when I just started gathering the nonprofit data, because nonprofits change a little bit more frequently than government units, you don't just up and create new cities and townships every day. Even the counties that we've got, again, were, you know, born during a time of horse and buggy, and we haven't changed those all that much. So when I do look at nonprofits, there was this kind of this idea out there too that social life was dying and withering and that people were less involved than they were before. And we've got this narrative of non-involvement. And I would say related to books like, you know, Bowling Alone, Social Capital is in Decline, and that people aren't showing up at city council meetings. But at the same time, the first run through the data showed me that from 2000 to 2010, while we had a 10% gain in the number of people in the country, there was a 32% gain in the number of nonprofits. And even in the most rural counties where we lose people, like 1% to 5% of people, the number of nonprofits still went up by 15%. And, you know, that obviously is not the story of just this death and doom of nonprofits across the country. It just kind of startled me that we had such great numbers. And then when I look at Minnesota, and we had an 8% gain in population over those 10 years and a 19% gain in the number of nonprofits. Even in the most rural counties where we lose 5% of people, the number of nonprofits went up by 14%. So that really led me down the road of, wait a minute, maybe it's not dying. maybe things are changing, just like with rural communities as they've gone through their history. We just don't have all these dead towns laying all around. We actually have towns that have persisted and remained vital despite all these changes. So then we start looking a little bit deeper into the data. And we know generally, when you look at the type of state we are here in Minnesota, we pass things like the Legacy Amendment. And obviously people are very engaged in the arts community, in recreational communities, and we start to see a trend in how people change their leadership and how they change where they want to be involved. And so we've seen this before. If you'd go back to 1880, you know, the number of nonprofits and social civic organizations you'd have would be geared around things like farrier groups or homemaker groups or, you know, temperance groups, the anti-sin and vice folks. And we don't have them anymore. And why is that? And it's because generally social groups reflect society's interests at any given time. And so we don't have those groups because of a lot of different reasons, but we've got new groups here today. And so I think what I've seen is that there's just a general lack of understanding of how our nonprofit structures have changed over the years and where people have shifted their time. So while they may not be in the city council, they're in the recreational groups or the health and wellness type groups. So really it's just a shift in where people want to spend their time and less about an overall decline in social involvement.
And so really we're looking at, when you say nonprofit, you're not just talking about the local social service agency that's maybe helping homelessness, but you're talking about the hockey groups and the snowmobile groups and those types of organizations as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. We got arts, culture, and humanities types groups, environmental groups, animal-related groups, and, you know, animal-related, I'll say, is like, you know, Eagles and Lions clubs animals, but at the same time, I like animal welfare and shelter type groups that have actually had very large increases in Minnesota here. Yes, we do have human services. This also includes things like hospitals. Many of us have nonprofit hospitals in our communities, includes those as well as, and churches, which makes up, you know, one of the biggest sectors we've got. So, there is a diverse landscape in terms of where people, you know, have historically spent their time. And it's somewhat interesting to kind of look through that data. And you do see declines in certain areas. The societal groups like the Eagles and the Lions have lost a number of groups over the years. But again, like here in Minnesota, we've seen great gains in arts, recreation, health, and wellness type groups.
And do you see the shift or this gap in leaders just in greater or rural Minnesota, or do you also see it in the urban and metropolitan areas as well?
Yeah, both, really. It's all across the landscape. So we do tend to see a higher growth in the number of nonprofits in the metro, but that's really an artifact of they just have more people. So I tend not, you know, we got to find some way to compare that. So what we actually found is a good way to compare that is to look at, like, you know, a lot of social scientists like to use like number of groups per 10,000 people, but that really, then you're at like 0.5 groups per 10,000 people or whatever, right? Which is hard to interpret. So actually, if you invert that, I created an indicator called population per organizational role. And this looks at how many people in your community does each group have to tap into to look for a leader. So for example, Nicollet County has a population per organizational role of 8. One in 8 people have to serve as a nonprofit leader, or, you know, again, we include government in this because they require leaders to your elected and appointed positions. So, we found a variety of demands, or what we call this, like leadership demand. And we find a lot of variety across the state. In this. But what we generally found is that urban areas have obviously many more people to tap into as a nonprofit leader than we have in our more rural parts of the state. So in urban Minnesota, 1 in 51 people have to serve as a leader in their community, while in the most rural parts of the state, it's down to 1 in 16. So, you know, like one person per city block has to serve as a leader in our small towns and our rural places. And then you think about what are the impacts of, like, you're going to, you know, have to create a new group to help serve some type of mission. Like, How do you start building a new group when you've already got so many in your community? Or if you're holding a community event, how do you get the word out to everyone? How do you partner with people? This actually leads to way more questions than answers in terms of like, wow, now I better understand this. I better understand why we feel so much pressure in our town when, you know, it's hard to find somebody to step up for leadership. And, you know, rather than blaming people, blame our own success. Blame, you know, the fact that we've got so many nonprofits. And Minnesota, we're in the top 10 in the country in terms of nonprofits per person. And but that also means that we've got more groups that need leaders in our community. So there are a lot of implications here. It's obvious that, you know, every time a new nonprofit gets born in our rural environment, that there's even fewer people to tap into as a nonprofit leader. You know, you're competing for people, you're competing for time, i.e. volunteers, and for money. So if you've got 100 groups in your county and you keep tacking on 10 to 20%, it's going to have an impact that's going to place even more demands for people to lead in your rural community.
So what I'm hearing you say is that there is truth to some of the leadership fatigue that we hear when we're out in communities.
That's right. And it's significant. More so in our rural communities where these demands for leaders are so high. In fact, even when you look at growth in the nonprofit sector and you kind of account for the number of leaders that you need, like we create roughly enough nonprofits that demand almost 1,700 new leaders in Minnesota a year. And then when you look across the landscape, like how many training programs do we have? Like we've got our programs here in Extension that do like community leadership training and individual training. We've also got things like Blandon and the Blandon Foundation and the Bush Foundation. They do leadership training too. And, you know, I used to think years ago that, boy, we've got all these groups doing leadership training. Isn't there a bunch of overlap? And now I think there's not even near enough. Like we are not producing enough leaders to even keep up with the number of nonprofit growths that we see. So it's kind of, you know, on one hand, it's a really great thing to know that people feel comfortable enough to start new nonprofits, that they're associating in ways that reflect their interests and they're finding a vitality in their own community. But at the same time, it does lead to these upward pressures in terms of number of leaders that we need in our small towns. And we look at a number of different solutions. You know, on one side, we just keep training new leaders. But the other is, how much better can we have organizations work with each other, right? If we've got organizations that are siloed out and you've got and that number is growing, this is ultimately going to lead to even more fragmentation in our community. So, you know, are there ways to help bridge these organizations and to bridge communities in our counties? Which is why, honestly, I'm a big fan of our own bridging programs here in Extension, is that I see this as a solution to help solve this issue of fragmentation of our nonprofit sectors.
They are great programs. I will agree with you there. So when you look at kind of bridging those organizations, I've heard you mention the unpopular idea that maybe some organizations have just reached their peak, have exceeded their lifespan. If there was a shift in organizations, do you think that it would address some of these leadership issues?
Yeah, you know, I think all of us can name a nonprofit or two that has the same three or four people at it, and then they wonder where everybody's at, and nobody's coming to their meetings. But ultimately, they've lost the gas, right? And it's interesting when you look back on even the work of Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a Frenchman in the early 1800s who traveled around the eastern seaboard of the U.S., and he wondered, like, what is so unique about America? And one of the things he wrote about in his book, Democracy in America, was that Americans have this very distinct way of organizing, that whenever there's a challenge in the community, that Americans band together, form an association, rise up, meet the challenge, and then dissipate back down. And then when the next challenge comes about, they band back together, form an association, and dissipate back down. And that's an incredible model, but there's one distinct part of that that we never do, and that's dissipate. Like, when is the last time we voluntarily, you know, closed our nonprofit? Like, hey, our work is done, right? We don't. Right. And it's almost comical, but it's so serious in its implications here, in that we don't just voluntarily close our nonprofit. We feel like, oh, we've been doing this for 20 years. We should keep doing it. Well, maybe you shouldn't. Like, maybe there are ways to help not only keep this leadership going, but to help reinvigorate other groups by partnering with other organizations. And maybe it means closing your doors. But when you close the doors, those leaders need to move somewhere else, which means the other groups need to be receptive and open to, you know, welcoming new leaders that may not talk the same language, that may not like have the same ways of achieving a goal. And we tend to see this in many communities where, you know, for instance, you move to a small town and you get invited to sit on a board. Well, then you wonder like, well, who's on the board and what are they doing? And a lot of times it's like, well, here's the five things we do every year. And, you know, which one do you want to sign up for? When I would argue that there is a great need to allow organizations the flexibility to welcome these new ideas by, I call it clearing the slate. Clear the slate of 20% of your activities every couple of years and let the newcomers in that group define what that group means for them. Because ultimately, you can have your mission and many ways to get there. And I would argue there are really strategic ways that organizations can use this strategy to not only welcome newcomers, but to bring them into leadership roles in the future.
So you've mentioned a little bit that maybe our approach needs to be a bit different. If our listeners are living in a community and they feel like they've put up flyers, they have done everything they can to bring people into their organization, have they really done everything? Or what do you think are some of the best strategies to get newcomers or just new leaders involved in organizations?
Yeah, I would say it always starts with a small request. And that request cannot be, do you want to sit on the board? It is more about like, hey, we're having a pancake supper to help the firemen on Saturday morning. Do you want to help us out? Like, you know, it is the very personal side of community life. You know, one of the things that we talk about is like there are strategies for helping get people out. So, for example, if you're going to have a community meal, how do you get the word out about that? Right? You put it on the radio. Well, I've listened to Pandora and I haven't listened to our local radio station forever. Well, we'll put it in the newspaper. Kind of same thing. If I happen to not visit the website for a week, then I'm going to miss that. There's community calendars out there. There's things like Facebook. And if you're on Facebook, you're over the age of 35. Well, we do email. Well, then you're over the age of 25. The number one method for successful invitations is text messaging. But honestly, text messaging starts with a relationship. You cannot cold call or cold text, you know, newcomers to your town. So I ask people, like, when is the last time you invited a newcomer over for supper? When is the last time you spent time with people? And I work from the premise that we have what I call this warm body syndrome. And I think we talked about it in the last podcast too, that, you know, when we talk about getting people into our jobs, they're a warm body. When I talk about like, we need new board members. Oh, there's John. He's new in town. Let's, you know, get him on the board. Well, he's a warm body. Like, do you even know if John is interested in this group or, you know, I mean, so there's a lot of personal work that needs to take place before leadership gets talked about. Like, it starts with engagement and then can lead to leadership over time. So I think there are just differences in how the younger generations want to participate and how they want to communicate. And at the same time, it's very much a decentralized approach to leadership. And it's, again, like decentralized power structures that we know about today. You know, there's not just one person in charge of our town. We've got decentralized power structures. There's a lot of different kind of pockets of power around town. So, and the same idea holds in terms of going to a meeting. So younger people generally do not want to sit through a meeting where they're listening to five or six other committees update the board on what's going on. I don't want to sit through, you know, an hour listening to something I'm really not, I would say, honestly, interested in. So moving away from committee work and moving towards task forces, or then you're just reporting on things that got done. Very short, very brief. So I think there are a lot of different strategies like that. You need to play with that. But at the heart of this is really just engaging the newcomers, talking to them about what they're interested in. And again, engagement before leadership, and start with a small request.
what have you seen or heard in communities that you think is a great model? I know that there's a community that is looking at doing some newcomer dinners. Is there anything else like that that you've seen and just said, wow, this is amazing, the way that they're engaging their newcomers?
Yeah, I mean, even in Northeast Minnesota, there's a group called Regen, which is helping newcomers just socially organize. Let's get together for different events they've got. They've got educational events. They've got entertainment events. So I think there's a lot of strategies out there, but it's got to be in many ways born from those newcomers. So in many ways, helping to facilitate the social connections between newcomers is more effective than just saying, hey, there's a newcomer, let's get them to my meeting. Rather, it's more about, can I help newcomers connect with each other? And honestly, once you get people in the same room, they'll organize themselves in many ways. Like, you can prompt them with some very basic community development practices out there. But, you know, human beings are social animals. We are going to organize ourselves. So it's less about organizing life for people and more about providing opportunities for people to socially engage each other.
Thank you again for spending some time, Ben, with us talking about the leadership gap today, and I look forward to hearing more about this important research in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Chrissy.
Thank you again to Ben Winchester for being our guest today. To learn more about the work that Ben and our colleagues at the Center for Community Vitality are doing, visit our website at extension.umn.edu/community. Here you will find more information on the leadership gap, the brain gain, and other resources to help you address the leadership needs in your community. Visit the Leadership and Civic Engagement Alumni blog to read more about what Extension is doing to help communities prepare their future leaders. Also, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay connected with the latest news and resources from the Center for Community Vitality. Thank you again for joining us for this episode of Vital Connections On Air.